class. We are not a random collection of individuals. We are a political group. We share a common condition, and that condition is called oppression. But the solution was embedded in the problem. If we share a common condition, we can also make common cause. And that group solidarity of making that common cause, that can give us the power to dislodge a corrupt, unjust system like patriarchy. So she did all that in three words. This is a very radical title. Then as today, women face both daily and lifelong insults to our intelligence, our bodies, our integrity, our lives. But in 1970, sexual harassment wasn't a legal concept yet. The words domestic and violence also hadn't been put together yet. The reality of women's lives was almost unspeakable. Now, this wave of feminism came naturally out of the work that women were doing in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. And the reason's obvious. Once you have a political framework, you can just sort of keep extending it. So women extended it to their own lives. They took those basic political insights and applied them to their own experiences, particularly in consciousness raising. They got together in small groups and just started comparing the details of what they'd been through. And you suddenly realize it's not just me. It didn't happen to me as an individual. It happened to all of us, and it happened because we're women. And so that was the truth. Men were brutalizing women on a mass scale. The institutions from the church to the media to the government to the courts were all colluding in it, and women had very little recourse. Women's lives provided the raw material for the feminist analysis that emerged and the political movement that followed. Women realized that gender was a social category, not a natural category. A social category, not a natural category. I could stand here all day and say that because I am so tired of being accused of being, quote, an essentialist. We are the people who have argued this is political, it's social, it is not natural. And what we argued is that masculinity is the primary organizing principle of the entire culture. So everything from militarism to racism to environmental devastation, at the core of it is something about masculinity and that violation imperative. We also argue that there were no individual solutions to political problems. So with the feminist analysis, women's lives start to make sense. And those really unspeakable horrors, the battering, rape, incest, prostitution, those began to find language as well. And language became theory, and theory became action, and round again. Meanwhile, 1972, Deep Throat. This is the first porn movie to go mainstream. And it doesn't take long, little girls start turning up in emergency rooms with gonorrhea in their throats. So they created a new kind of rape. 5 years later, Snuff, 1977, this arrives in the movie theaters. It only took 5 years to go from Deep Throat to Snuff. 5 years was all. And you know the plot, right? It ends with a man slicing open a woman's uterus and then ejaculating. So, you know, that's the money shot. Men lined up at 5 o'clock in the morning to see this movie. In 1981, Linda Marciano, the woman used in Deep Throat, she's finally able to tell the story of captivity, rape, torture at the hands of Chuck Traynor. Andrea Dworkin, Gloria Steinem, and Catherine McKinnon all together tried to find some kind of legal remedy to win her justice, but there simply wasn't one, and there still isn't. So there's two things going on across the culture at this point. One, there's an explosion of feminism, and two, there's an explosion of pornography. Feminism gave a few brave women the tools, which is to say the critical framework, to look at the pornography. And Andrea Dworkin, of course, was our bravest. She tried to figure out how all those social practices of male violence fit together. This is a quote. Pornography is not a metaphor for what women are. It is what women are, in theory and in practice. Okay. She's saying that pornography is not an idea. It's not speech. It's reality as women have to live it. And it's the first time that anyone said that. And what it means is that all of us are living inside this barricade of sexual terrorism. She also suggested these models, and this is a long quote. It does not matter whether prostitution is perceived as the surface condition, with pornography hidden in the deepest recesses of the psyche, or whether pornography is perceived as the surface condition, with prostitution being its wider, more important hidden base. The largely unacknowledged sexual economic necessity of women. Rape, battery, economic exploitation, and reproductive exploitation require pornography as female metaphysics so as to be virtually self-justifying, virtually invisible abuses. And they also require the wall of prostitution confining women so that women are always absolutely accessible. The heart of pornography and the wall of prostitution mirror each other in that both are meant to mean that women deserve the crimes that define their condition. The meaning of this description is simple for feminists. breaking the circle up, breaking down the wall, annihilating the system's heart, are what we must do. She was absolutely right, and we took that seriously because women matter to us. So here's my handy chart. I have four planets in Virgo, and I like my charts. So this is sex across the political spectrum. On the right, sex is bad, and it's an impulse that has to be controlled in some way. On the left, sex is good, and it's an impulse that needs to be liberated. For feminists, it's actually completely different. Sex is what human societies make of it. So it could be good, like pleasure or connection. It could be bad, like rape or prostitution. On the right, some sex is natural, so intercourse and heterosexual marriage. Some sex is unnatural and bad, and usually that's, it would be, you know, gay sex, lesbian sex. On the left, all sex is natural and beyond examination. And you can't question nature, you can't question God. If it's natural, it's natural. Feminists, again, completely different. It's political. Sexual practices are created by humans. On the right, sex is naturally hierarchical. It involves punishing women and breaking boundaries. What do you know on the left? Sex is naturally hierarchical. It involves punishing women and breaking boundaries. Feminists, totally different. This culture defines sex as eroticized domination and subordination, starting with masculine and feminine. On the right, women need to accept and enjoy their place in the hierarchy. On the left, women need to accept and enjoy their place in the hierarchy. Feminists, women need to fight back.
Yeah.
Sexual practices with eroticized domination need to be abandoned. And finally, on the right, that normal place is private, so one man owns one woman in marriage, you know, in some kind of legal contract. On the left, it's public, so now we're all for sale in the public square, and that would be called pornography. All men need access to all women. Okay, there's no way to say no. And feminists, boundaries are absolute and need to be respected within a culture that cherishes and protects physical integrity. Now, because feminism came out of the left, that was the natural trajectory of it, we made tremendous efforts not to name sex, because on the left, sex is automatically good. And also because we were rightfully afraid of the insults that men use when you question or reject their system. So everything from, you know, you're a prude, to the classic, you just need A. You all know how that ends, right? You know, it's been 6,000 years. You think they could come up with something new? And you'll notice it's never, you need a good book, you need a good back rub, you need some good chocolate. No, it's always the same thing. So we get accused of being in bed with the right, but I got to tell you, right and left are looking pretty cozy here. Now, unfortunately, ultimately, when we question sex, what we're questioning is, of course, male entitlement to women's bodies. Sex is the form that primarily takes, and that's the brilliance of the patriarchy. It eroticizes domination and subordination. It sexualizes acts of oppression. In any other circumstance, we would know this was oppression. But when men do it to women, it's called sex. And by making them into sex, it naturalizes them, which makes it really hard to question. So the patriarchal ideology is that masculinity and femininity were set in place when the universe was created. Whether that was by God or by nature, it doesn't matter. Okay, I mean, the right prefers God, the left prefers nature, but all this is set in stone somewhere. For feminists, though, masculinity and femininity, those are political creations of a brutal arrangement of power. It's a human creation. It's not natural. And masculinity is simply ritualized domination. Femininity is just ritualized displays of submission. It's just the traumatized psyche writ large. Eroticizing domination and subordination does not change the fact that it's a corrupt system of power. It's great camouflage. It's very confusing for people. But it's still what it is, a brutal and corrupt arrangement of power. And that's the baseline insight of radical feminism. Now, we tried to be good girls. We tried to be nice girls. And on the left, that means you say yes, because good girls say yes. And so we came up with this idea that, you know, rape was violence, not sex. That doesn't work. If it's violence and not sex, why is he ejaculating? I mean, if it's violence, not sex, why does he get an erection each and every time? If it was just violence, he would simply hit her and be done with it. So yeah, some of us were willing to commit treason and name men, and then we went on to commit blasphemy by noticing that their abuse was sexualized. You know, in fact, they've done studies to try to find out, well, what's the difference? Sex, violence, what do we know about this? And no matter what they show, I mean, they've made movies, men kicking women, men punching women, men pulling women's hair. It doesn't matter. At least a quarter of the men in the audience will get an erection. So you can't make the distinction anymore. It's completely collapsed. Anything that men do to women that hurts them is read as sex by the men who do it. So there's no distinction. Okay, so first Take Back the Night March was in Belgium in 1976. Yay, Belgians. And then in Rome the same year, in 1977, there were marches in West Germany, and then in England, and then in San Francisco in 1978. There was a conference called Feminist Perspectives on Pornography, and that was the first Take Back the Night march in the U.S. And women marched through the porn district, and women who were being prostituted joined them in the street. And then in 1979, this book came out. And then in 1980, this book. So one response to this analysis of women's oppression was the creation of rape crisis hotlines, battered women's shelters, legal challenges, all kinds of laws that made marital rape illegal, to create restraining orders for women who were being battered and stalked, rape shield laws so you could go to court and not have your sexual history on display, all these legal and social initiatives that women put forward. But there were other currents as well. One was the creation of a specifically lesbian feminist identity and culture. So calling into question concepts of masculinity and femininity, realizing these weren't natural, but instead political, understanding that heterosexuality was a political institution. Well, it kind of blew our minds, but feeling the horror of our own collusion and submitting to everything from beauty practices to out-and-out abuse. Some of us wanted liberty. We didn't want to give our primary loyalty to men. We didn't want to be conflicted in our ability to name them or stop them. And loving women instead meant we wouldn't have to lie to ourselves personally or collectively. Maybe it would be liberatory personally and collectively. If all of this is socially constructed, why not reconstruct ourselves? So some of us actively chose lesbianism as both a personal and a political bid for freedom. Our analysis and the experiences that we drew from this still stand as a profound challenge to patriarchy. We created our own culture, our own rituals, our own institutions, all based on a commitment to being woman-identified instead of male-identified, so putting women at the center. We said that every woman's body wasn't just beautiful, but sacred, and we meant it. And we were the beating heart of radical feminism. Now, lest you think I'm romanticizing, things are about to get really ugly. We are now up to 1982, and this book basically dropped like a bomb into the feminist community. San Juan was a support group for lesbian sadomasochists in San Francisco, their most famous member being Pat Califia, who you are going to hear a lot about in the next 30 minutes. This book broke my heart in ways that will never heal. Now, besides a lot of very boring fiction, there are two basic arguments in this book. Now, at this stage, which is 1982, some of these writers still want to recognize that male violence is real, and pornography is part of it. This seems rather miraculous looking back, but in fact, that's in there. Male violence actually exists, it does hurt women, and pornography is recognized as something that's part of that. So, the first argument is that it's different when women make pornography or eroticize sadism. Why is it different? Just because. Here's a quote. SM is about sexual power, and specifically about lesbians becoming more powerful through their sexuality. That's the entire extent of the argument. Okay, from 1982 until now, it hasn't actually changed. If a woman feels sexual, that feeling is somehow synonymous with political power. Not true for any other group on the planet, but for women, you have a sexual feeling, now you've got political power. Not running for president, not getting an education, not fighting male violence, no. Simply having a sexual feeling is defined as political power. I'd say that's setting the bar a wee bit low. Okay, the next three pictures are graphic, so, you know, don't feel that you must inflict this on yourselves. Another argument that they use a lot at this stage is that doing this to each other is a way to heal from abuse. Now, this is in opposition to everything that we know about the human psyche and how it heals from trauma, but we're supposed to keep re-traumatizing ourselves as a way to recovery. I've also had women say to me point blank, I can't change what my father did to me, but I can learn to enjoy it. Begging the question, why would you want to learn to enjoy violation, human rights abuses, beyond me. Okay, the deepest layer of their framework, and this is really the heart of it, is that power is everywhere, in every human interaction, and the sadomasochists are the ones that are at least honest about that. The implication being, of course, that the rest of us are liars. The interesting thing is that you can sort of look at this diagnostically from a psychological perspective. That is the perspective of the child who's been abused, particularly sexually abused. I mean, Judith Herman and other trauma experts talk about this a lot, that when you grow up being abused, you do see everything in terms of power. It's one of the things you have to do to heal, to get over abuse, is to stop seeing everything in terms of who's got power, who's going to hurt me, am I powerful, am I powerless in this interaction, and simply see that, you know, there are good people in the world who don't mean to hurt you. But children who are abused tend to see that, that everything is about power. That's what the sadomasochist said, that there's no human interaction that does not involve power. So you know, of the relationships that do involve power, our society actually recognizes that that power makes them explicitly off limits to sexual interactions. It's illegal for professors to have sex with students. You know, you lose your job, the university can get sued. It's illegal for doctors to have sex with patients. You will lose your license. It's illegal for adults to have sex with children. You can go to jail for that. So the extent to which men use sex to abuse those over whom they have power, that's exactly the reason that the feminist movement exists. Right? We want to stop employers from sexually harassing their employees. We want to stop professors from using this against female students. We want to stop doctors from raping women who needed abortions. We want to stop husbands from having legal rights over the women they owned as their wives and their daughters. That's exactly the reason that feminism started. So this SM strategy of continuing to eroticize those relations of power will never free women and children, because that's the exact connection, sexual arousal and power, that needs to be forever broken. Okay, they're also lying about consent. Consent is the public facade. One layer deeper into this literature and into this community, and you'll find their admission that a, quote, good top doesn't care about consent, that a good top knows how far to push a bottom. And, you know, the famous, the classic example, at least from the 80s, Pat Califia carved a swastika into another woman's arm. Do I need to mention she was Jewish and did not consent? And the only thing that Pat can say in her defense is, well, I didn't actually carve it, I scratched it. So the stories in this book involve various kinds of humiliation and bondage and instructions on how to cut people with razor blades. Eventually, of course, you get to children. So in this book, Sam Waugh, you know, the editors, they publicly support pedophiles. So this is Gail Rubin. It's crucial to add that not all adults who have sex with children or have sex with minors are molesting or harming them. Past a certain point, I don't know how to argue. So next up, still 1982, the infamous Barnard Conference. You know, it's funny because we all just say Barnard and we know what we're talking about, but it actually did have a title. I had to look it up. I was like, what the hell was that conference actually called? It wasn't called Barnard. You know, that's a school. It was actually called Towards a Politics of Sexuality. And this was the book they put out that collected all the papers from the conference. Okay, the editor is Carol Vance. Remember that name because she's going to come up again. So both Pat Califia and Gail Rubin are in this book. And these authors are arguing this classic sex liberal approach, except the only thing new is they've added the word agency to their repertoire. And that's a word you're going to hear a lot. Women are supposed to claim their agency. So I actually read the whole book. I didn't do it in 1982, but I've done it since. And I got to tell you, it took me an entire pint of Ben & Jerry's to get through this.
Yeah.
Ben & Jerry, my gentleman friends. So this is literally the second line of the book. To speak only of sexual violence and oppression ignores women's experience with sexual agency and choice and unwittingly increases the sexual terror and despair in which women live. Okay, this is like blaming abolitionists for slavery. So like pointing out the bad thing somehow makes it worse. I guess we can keep our heads in the sand. I don't actually think that that's a viable political strategy. I think we have to actually say how bad it is. Another line, the feminist critique emphasized the ubiquity of sexual danger and humiliation in a patriarchal surround, initially useful as an ideological interruption. And here I would just like to point out, we didn't want an ideological interruption. We actually wanted to stop rape. This critique now shares the same undialectical and simplistic focus as its opposition. You know, I actually do think that rape is really simple. It brutalizes some of us and it terrorizes all of us. And if that makes me undialectical, well, I have been called worse. So if women increasingly view themselves entirely as victims through the lens of the oppressor and allow themselves to be viewed that way by others, they become enfeebled and miserable. I personally think that, yes, incest is enfeebling and immiserating, which is why they do it to us. Now, this is a very neat liberal trick because it erases the material conditions, right? If we just view ourselves differently, we won't be enfeebled and miserable. And this is the first time this argument is really articulated, and it becomes the basis for that, quote, sex positive and, you know, third wave politics. It's blaming the victim on a mass scale. Our attitude is not the problem, and radical feminists are not the ones leaving women enfeebled and miserable. We are the ones that suggested everything from lawsuits to self-defense to lesbian nation as possible solutions to male supremacy. One happy example, 1988, let's see, a whole bunch of us got arrested. I used to live in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we took over the downtown. There's a big main intersection. It's a pretty small town. We took over the whole downtown intersection, and then some of us got arrested. We didn't actually mean to, and then there was this huge standoff with the police, but, you know, the punchline was we had traffic backed up all the way to the interstate for about 3 miles. And we had big signs, stop the trafficking women. I thought that was really clever. We made pornography. That worked. And then on Monday morning, we were arraigned and, of course, charged with disturbing the peace. And when they read out the charge, everyone who didn't get arrested jumped up with these big banners, and they said, we were all chanting, we are disturbing the war against women. So you can actually see me there. I can point out who I am.
I don't actually look very different. This one's me right here.
You know, the point is, we weren't short on ideas, and we weren't short of courage. The only thing we were ever short on was soldiers, right? We're not the ones who can't imagine a way out of this. All right, Carol Vance, this is a long one. In examining these domains in which women's sexuality is described or represented, the observer, interpreter, or scholar is striving to understand what the various representations mean. Okay, gagonmycock.com. Really? You have to strive to understand something there. So to answer this question, the analyst applies an interpretive frame through which meaning can be detected and inferred. Do we assume that all women share this interpretive frame, that it is universal? Well, they're called universal human rights for a reason. So yes, I would say this is universal. To assume that symbols have a unitary meaning, the one the dominant culture assigns them, is to fail to investigate the individual's experience and cognition of symbols, as well as individual ability to transform and manipulate symbols. Okay, once more, we aren't trying to change symbols. Rape is not a symbol, it's a material reality, and that's what we have in our sights, is to change those material conditions. And second, you know, it doesn't actually matter whether I think, you know, a short skirt is frolicky fun on a Friday night. If the culture I live in thinks that it means I deserve to be raped. Okay, I, as an individual, cannot transform and manipulate symbols in any way that's socially meaningful. So this is pure liberalism applied to women. Manipulate symbols in a complex way which draws on play, creativity, humor, and intelligence. Okay, well, play, creativity, humor, and intelligence are not political strategies. I'll just point out. I mean, they're fine things in their own right. Political strategies, they are not. This assumption grants mainstream culture a hegemony it claims but rarely achieves. Now, we're having a postmodern moment, and it's only 1982. We're going to try a thought experiment. Group of friends in random place, Guantanamo Bay. Wee bit concerned about habeas corpus. One of them says, hey, aren't we denying ourselves agency? Rendering ourselves enfeebled and miserable by assuming the unitary meaning of these symbols. Let's get some orange jumpsuits and black hoods. We'll put them on, and if we can make an intelligent, ironic, even playful stance toward these symbols, we'll challenge the dominant culture, which, as we know, is never as hegemonic as it claims to be. You get my point? You can be as playful and ironic as you want. It doesn't change the material conditions, and we're still living in that barricade of sexual terrorism. Okay, well, back to Gail Rubin. It's like, again, with the pedophiles. Boy lovers are so stigmatized that it is difficult to find defenders for their civil liberties, let alone their erotic orientation. I should hope so. I don't know if any of you have been following the Sandusky trial this week. I will admit that at my point, this point in my career as a radical feminist, I don't often cry about this stuff anymore. You sort of give up after a while. It doesn't really help. Victim number 9 got me. Sandusky took him into the basement and raped him, and he said he screamed and no one heard. And that's what we're talking about. Children in basements being raped until they scream and no one hears. And this is what they want to defend. Yeah. So Gail Rubin's article called Thinking Sex, Notes for a Radical Theory of the Politics of Sexuality. This woman who defends pedophiles, this is foundational, this article, foundational to queer theory. This is what they built it on. So the basic idea is we're not allowed to question sexuality or any sexual practices. We're not allowed to question them. In her view, sexuality is somehow oppressed. Now, it's not a person, so I don't know how it can be oppressed. But that's her view. It's oppressed. And the only people who can liberate poor, oppressed sexuality are the sadomasochists and the sexual libertarians, which are the pedophiles and the pornographers. So those are her freedom fighters, the rapists and the pimps. Okay, so it's still 1982. Up comes the ordinance. Now, we've already had a really great talk about the ordinance, so I think I can actually skip this. But I will point out, Minneapolis, where this started, it was 98% white, 2% people of color. 100% of the pornography was in the neighborhoods of people of color. And the women who lived there, 4 times as likely to be raped. So you can draw your own conclusions. Anyway, Lori did a great job on that. So I can just skip the next few pages. You know, again, the real brilliance of their approach is that pornography is what pornography does. So this whole idea that feminists have that this is a social process, and what does it take to get women into it? What happens to women because of it? And that's what the ordinance gave us, was a way to make that legally actionable. Okay, and then the definition. This is the book, In Harm's Way, that Lori mentioned, that's all of the public testimony about the ordinance. So then there was an amicus brief that there was, of course, backlash to the ordinance, and it mostly came, of course, from the pornographers themselves. But on the, quote, feminist side of the equation, there was a group called FACT, the Feminist Anti-Censorship Task Force. And they put together an amicus brief that was submitted to the Seventh Circuit Court, and it was signed by all kinds of women who formerly called themselves feminists. Carol Dance from the Barnard Conference was one of the authors of the brief, and here's a quote. Some proponents of this ordinance genuinely believe that it would assist women to overcome the disabling sexual stereotypes and promote greater equality for women. We believe that the ordinance reinforces, rather than undercuts, central sexist stereotypes in our society. Okay, what they're saying, once again, is that pornography is an idea, and that male violence is not a brutal fact of life, but simply a stereotype that we all need to get over, as if we need an attitude adjustment instead of actual justice. So this is the same thing that she argued at Barnard, except now she's doing it to a court. The ordinance reinforces the notion that women are too fragile and men too uncontrollable, absent the aid of a censor, to be trusted to reject or enjoy sexually explicit speech for themselves. Okay, it's not a notion or an idea that women are fragile. It is a fact that around the globe we are brutalized, okay? Bought, sold, made less than human, and we all know the statistics. It's not a notion that men are uncontrollable. It's a fact that men will rape 1 in 3 women in their lifetime. They aren't uncontrollable. They are controlling, specifically us, through this kind of terror. Again, the barricade. Remember that barricade of sexual terrorism. Keep this in your mind always when you fight with these people. This is the same argument that the, quote, pro-sex side keeps advancing. Ellen Willis is the first person to suggest the phrase sex-positive feminism. That was in 1981. This term, pro-sex, it functions just like pro-life in what it implies, of course, about the opposition. So now, of course, I'm anti-sex as well as being anti-life. The central argument of sex liberals is that if women claim their agency, patriarchy will be over. So for them, the problem with patriarchy isn't men's sexual violence. The problem is that patriarchy makes women afraid of being sexual. We need to get over that and claim our inner psycho sluts. So the ordinance was dead in the water. Half the movement was accommodating to objectification and sexual sadism. But there was a couple other confluent forces that destroyed the movement. One is always the economy. You know, when the economy gets worse, it's just harder for movements that don't have a lot of money. But I would actually say AIDS was a big factor here. And that's because once the epidemic really hit the gay community, lesbians pretty well abandoned the project of a specifically lesbian feminist community and went to help men, which is what women always do. And what it meant was that there's a whole generation of lesbians right after me. I was the cutoff point. They got socialized into gay male culture instead of being socialized into a specifically lesbian feminist culture. I mean, really broadly, most of us aren't socialized into feminist culture. We come to feminism much later, you know, as adolescents or in our early 20s or, you know, wherever it is that we bump into it. But we're not raised in that culture. We have to find it later. And that generational link got broken because of the emergency of AIDS. In my case, that's not actually true. My mother went to consciousness raising in 1972. The glorious result stands before you. It's actually, I mean, I remember her telling us why, you know, what was wrong with Barbie dolls and war toys as well. But my little sister once said to her, "Oh, Mommy, you're as beautiful as Miss America." And my mother said, "Thank you for the compliment, but I'm going to tell you why I don't actually like Miss America." And she gave us this great little talk. Of course, the thing that stands out in my mind, I was 7, the thing that stands out was her punchline, because she builds up, I know it's very dramatic, builds up to this great punchline, and finally she says, "I mean, no one makes men parade around on stage showing off their penises." And we were like, but anyway, it's not good. It really took. Okay, so for a while, the term sort of sexual minorities, they try that. That doesn't really work. Eventually, queer becomes the term. And that replaces all of this, both as a title and a specific politic. So by the late 80s, The ideas that would define queer begin to coalesce around that identity. So in 1982, Samwa and the like, they're still attempting to make some kind of feminist argument about pornography and about sadomasochism. You know, it's kind of ridiculous, but feminism was still something that they wanted to value. But by the late 80s, they're not even trying anymore. It doesn't matter. Sexual practices need no defense. Arousal, by definition, is its own defense. All sexual activity is out of the realm of ethical investigation, and that leaves women and girls in hell. So, to question, to investigate the deepest meanings of such a profound human activity, you now risk being called a prude or worse. So, we're back to that classic right versus left of whether sex is good or bad, controlled or liberated, private or public, which will bring us right back to Pat Kalypia. Book of Stories, let me tell you, the writing is excellent. But the high point of this book is when a woman pays a group of men to impersonate cops and kidnap and rape her lover as a, quote, birthday present. So that's the level. Another book by dear Pat. What do you even say?
Not a lesbian.
Well, public sex. So this is interesting because she calls it public sex, but in fact, the entire thing has been completely reprivatized. Okay, so queer theory and postmodernism are pretty well synonymous. You need to know about postmodernism. The two guys who really founded it were both French gay men, and they belong to pedophile organizations that actively try to repeal age of consent laws. I don't just mean drop age of consent. Repeal age of consent laws so that adults could have complete sexual access to children. That's who founded postmodernism, Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. That was what they did, okay, in their actual lives. And that's the foundation of this. No surprise, right? So you can make yourself read through this kind of silliness, but basically they believe nothing is real. There's no theoretical certainty about identity or anything else. One theorist writes, the ultimate challenge of awareness, however, is not just the questioning of the content of collective identities, but the questioning of the unity, stability, viability, and political utility of sexual identities, even as they are used and assumed. You can remember that next time you work in the hotline. I'm sure it will come in handy. This is from Wikipedia. Queer theory's main project is exploring the contestations of the categorization of gender and sexuality. Theorists claim that identities are not fixed. They cannot be categorized and labeled, because identities consist of many varied components, and that to categorize by one characteristic is wrong. For example, a woman can be a woman without being labeled a lesbian or feminist, and she may have a different race from the dominant culture. She should, for theorists argue, be classed as possessing an individual identity and not put in the collective basket of feminist or of color or the like. Okay, that spells the end of any hope of political change. That's why these people are profoundly liberal. Political change is always a collective project, and that's what it requires. You're not going to do it as an individual. And it's one of the cardinal differences between liberals and radicals. Everybody loves this. I'm famous for this liberal radical talk. You're only going to get the mini version, but this is funny. So liberals think that society is made up of individuals, and radicals see that society is made up of classes of people. So the basic social unit is completely different for liberals and radicals. And honestly, if you're a radical, this is the debt that we all owe Karl Marx. He was the one who got that. And in the original version, this was economic class. But, you know, people have extended that. And they now see that society is made up of groups of people, and some groups have power over others. It's not an individual condition, and there is no individual solution. And the other main difference is idealism versus materialism. So for liberals, attitudes, ideas, it all happens in the mind. So that's the prime mover of social life, and the best solutions for any problem is education, because you're trying to change the mind. That's where social reality occurs. Very different for radicals. There are concrete systems of power that control material reality, and that's what has to change if we're really going to change the world. So it requires organized political resistance. That's the engine of social change. Okay, so we don't have time to go over the rest of these, but Carol Vance and all the third waivers since, they're absolutely arguing that reality is simply an idea. And the problem is attitudes and stereotypes, and that puts these people firmly in the liberal camp. It's interesting once, because I did this presentation to a group of, it was mostly third waivers, and I got done doing the liberal radical part, and this one woman raised her hand, she goes, huh, I guess I'm a liberal. I was like, yeah, you got it. I just didn't expect anybody to actually say that, you know, because they, oh, I'm so radical, sex radical. But she got it. She's like, no, I'm a liberal. It's like, yes, you are actually. So take it or leave it. But there it is. So reality is all performance. Anything goes. The more, quote, transgressive, the better. The logical extension of this everywhere, and I mean everywhere that this pops up, this is where it ends, is children. You know, if your sexual response is trained to the breaking of boundaries, transgression, it ends with children, because there is no greater power differential. And there is no more vulnerable class of people who need to be forever removed from sexualization. This is where pop culture, porn culture, has dragged popular culture, and it's where the sex liberals have tried to drag the left. Pat Calippi says this point blank. It is condescending to assume that young people are so dazzled by the power of adults they cannot tell the difference between being molested and being in love or being horny. Any child old enough to decide whether or not she or he wants to eat spinach, play with trucks, or wear shoes is old enough to decide whether or not she or he wants to run around naked in the sun, masturbate, sit in somebody's lap, or engage in sexual activity. So I guess children have to claim their sexual agency too, so that they aren't miserable and victimized. This book had 70 pages devoted to defending pedophiles. 70 pages. And then, of course, another 30 pages trashing radical feminists. She also says, quote, "There is no middle ground. It is not possible to compromise with bigots and fanatics," by which she means radical feminists. And I'd actually agree there is no middle ground. You can't argue with sociopaths and sadists. Now, it's interesting to note that this book is called Public Sex. In fact, it totally reprivatizes desire and sexual practices, because they're declared completely off limits to any ethical investigation. So it's private sex. It's not public sex. Now, around about the year 2000, very interesting, Calippi changed her mind. Maybe it's not such a great idea for adults to fuck children. But, of course, the next big thing is animals, and maybe that's the new radical thing that Pat Calippi is suggesting. Okay, so 1982, Samwell, Barner, The Ordinance in 84, and right about then women start making, quote, their own pornography. So in the mainstream, you have Nina Hartley. She's like the Jenna Jameson of the 80s. She calls herself a feminist. She claims she wants to make, quote, woman-friendly pornography. Next bunch of slides are pretty ugly. You know, it looks exactly like all the other porn that I've ever seen, but she gets tons of airplay on print, TV, she's on Oprah, she's in over 400 films, and now, of course, she's aged out and she's pimping. So this is her website, all the movies she's made. This is from a description. Scene 5, Carmen trains her own plaything with a spanking before burying a glass dildo deep inside her gal pal's box as a reward. No indifferent, Nina. 1984 is also the year that the first, quote, lesbian porn magazine comes out, and it's called On Our Backs. So they at first insisted this was going to be different. Doesn't look any different to me. By the end of the 80s, that argument drops entirely by the wayside. There's nothing wrong with eroticizing domination and submission, nothing wrong with anything that gets you off. So the proponents of queer and what would come to be called third wave, there's no uneasy contradiction anymore. You find that in the Samwell book in 82. There's still this contradiction that you can see they're not happy about it. But at this point, it's gone. And they decide instead that what feminism means, no, not confronting male power, but anything a woman chooses, as long as she says she's choosing it. And that becomes the central tenet of third wave. This is where it all begins to coalesce. So a couple of these slides, sorry about this, but you can see this does not look one bit different. Okay, that's a rubber weenie. This woman is sucking on a piece of rubber, and somebody's supposed to be feeling pleasure? I just find this ridiculous. Okay, Susie Wright, State of the Union. She's the founding editor of On Our Backs magazine. She goes on to write for Penthouse. She writes for the Village Voice. She pretty much gets all the airtime that anybody could ever want, has this, you know, huge influence across the culture. Authors this book, it's a huge success, and these are her cornerstones of eroticism in the book. Longing and anticipation. You know, Susie Wright and I actually agree on that. I think that's fine. I think it's a fine thing to find erotic. You know, you can cue the Carly Simon and we can all sing that song about anticipation, whatever. But the next three, we've got a problem. Cornerstone of eroticism, violating prohibitions, searching for power, and overcoming ambivalence. Don't even know what to say. This was a wildly popular book, and it says that rape is the basis of eroticism. Violating prohibitions. I gotta say, no one's violating anything in my relationship, searching for power. That's what's replaced, searching for connection or communication, or God forbid, love, right? Are we allowed to even say love? Or has the culture been so destroyed by cynicism and sadism that love is now unspeakable? I know there's no ironic distance in saying love, Never mind the love that dare not speak its name. Love is now become unspeakable itself. And finally, we come to overcoming ambivalence. You know, I can't believe I have to say this, but if anyone is ambivalent, they're going to put on their shoes and their coat and go home until they decide. Overcoming ambivalence is not something that is erotic in the slightest. Are we out of time?
We're about 7 minutes over.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, then we had Madonna. See, she took over. That was the mainstream. This was her book, Sex. And she creates this media persona, willing objectification, and, of course, she says she wants it, wants it, wants it. You notice the word no up there on the upper left. Madonna, Madonna, we love Madonna, right? More Madonna, okay. Then there were a bunch of academics who wanted Madonna's studies, mm-hmm. and it's the same thing. She's chained to her desire, but she's in control, and isn't that what feminism is all about? So as long as you say you want it, that makes it feminist. Third wave. Oh, they've got all these ideas about, you know, fluid notions of gender, but, you know, one more time, this is nothing, there's nothing fluid about this. It's a caste system that's brutal, that's global, that's, you know, based on that barricade of sexual terrorism. You know, and they get to call themselves pro-sex, but, you know, you just have to ask, what is positive about this? And honestly, why would we care about this if the pornographers weren't destroying something that was precious? So I just, you know, we get tired of their terminology as well. Just going to skip all this. All right, finally, my last chart. Okay, here we go. The third wave. Power is inevitable. It's basic to the universe, to nature, to human relationships. Feminist. Power is political. It's created by human societies. They say power is always erotic. We say it's erotic within a male supremacy, but feminist resistance is possible, and it is possible to reclaim our sexuality from those patterns of domination and submission. The erotic cannot be questioned, is what they say. It's always good. We say no, and that link has to be broken. They say sexual arousal is beyond the realm of ethical investigation. We say that's not true. There's no area of human activity that's beyond that. They say the culture at large is repressive towards sexuality. I don't know what planet they're living on. I mean, they can't sell toothpaste without telling women's bodies at this point. And what the culture is oppressed to is women, not sexuality. They talk about agency, so anything a woman says she chooses is what feminism is. And this is one of my favorite quotes from Andrea. Feminism is the political practice of fighting male supremacy on behalf of women as a class. It does not get any simpler than that. And they also think there's nothing as interesting as reality. It's all a fractured text. It all signifies nothing. There's all these fluid identities. You can't make a definitive statement. And I would say universal human rights are called that for a reason. And honestly, if it was your face being smashed into a bloody pulp, you didn't know it was real. So they think it's subversive, transgressive, and radical to dress up like Nazis, to play master and slave. And we want a world where that's basically unthinkable. Every once in a while, one of these folks actually comes up and says, you know, the obvious thing. And so this is Amber Hollenbaugh, who's been trashing radical feminism since that Barnard conference. If the forbidden is connected to taboo, how can we resist oppression without destroying our means to excitement? And I got to say, Amber, that's your problem, not mine. Okay, here's the situation. I usually come with chocolate because I rarely come with good news. They've taken over popular culture, academia, the left. They are the media. They don't just own the media. And, you know, the leftist press, which should be on our side, is generally not. They're pretty well in love with pornography as well. We've got on our side courage. We've got the truth. We've got a great slideshow. We've got some really good books. That's about it. We need a movement, and we need it bad. And we need each of you to be that movement and to help fight to take back our culture from the pornographers before they destroy what's left of our humanity. So, five words. Thank you.